Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, February 4th, 2006. I'm Harley Schlanger. I'll be your host. Our show today will focus on a crucial aspect of the battle to defeat the fascist neocons centered around Vice President Dick Cheney. Following their success in imposing Judge Samuel Alito on the U.S. Supreme Court, Cheney and his allies have launched into a true flight forward, placing a war against Iran on the immediate agenda. While Bush, Rumsfeld, Bolton, and others are preparing for a preemptive strike against Iran's nuclear energy and research sites, the administration has launched simultaneously an all-out offensive against the U.S. Constitution, justifying illegal spying on Americans through the National Security Agency, holding prisoners without charges, and advocating torture, among other atrocities committed by this gang. Lyndon LaRouche pointed out that the Democrats in the Senate flinched on the Alito fight. True, there is a core which responded to LaRouche's call to action and stood up. There were 25 votes for a filibuster against Alito, but they failed largely because they did not identify Alito and his legal outlook for what it is: fascism, the return to the judicial and legal philosophy of Carl Schmitt, the jurist who drafted the emergency decrees for Hitler, which Hitler then used to impose his Nazi dictatorship. Now, as we've identified on this show previously, Alito and his allies are adherents of the same doctrine of law used by Schmitt for Hitler, which they are intending to apply now in support of a fascist dictatorship in the United States. One of the groups they work through is the misnamed Federalist Society, to which Alito and at least three other Supreme Court justices pledge allegiance. And this network is at the heart of the drive for fascism since its founding in 1982. And this has been documented in the Children of Satan 4 pamphlet, which is being circulated all over the country, including to U.S. senators. Now, central to their philosophy is sophistry, which will be the focus of our show today. Our special guest will be Jerry Rose, who has written and lectured extensively on this topic. Jerry, welcome to the show.
Hi, Harley.
We will also have a LIM panel, which will include today Quincy O'Neill from Los Angeles and Randy Kim from Washington, D.C. Now, Jerry, to prepare for the show, I was reading last night a recently published book by Victor Davis Hanson called A War Like No Other, How the Athenians and Spartans Fought the Peloponnesian War. Hanson is a self-admitted follower of Leo Strauss, and he argues, as a good sophist would, that the Peloponnesian War, though disastrous, was not really a dividing point or a punctum saliens in history. He said instead, and this is a quote from him, Athens did not lose the Peloponnesian War in 405-404 as much as suffer a two-year setback, before pressing ahead to rough parity and permanent peace with Sparta somewhere around 394. So for him and the neocons, it was just an interregnum. Now, when we were speaking earlier, you said that you saw this as an attack on what Lyndon LaRouche has said about the Peloponnesian War. So let's start by taking up this question. What is the essential issue of the Peloponnesian War?
Yeah, well, in fact, we had occasion to discuss this directly with Lynn last Tuesday, or this Tuesday, actually, because we are going to review this book, and the essential issue in the Peloponnesian War was not the particular way, which is what Hanson and others try to get into, which is the typical flat Earth view of history, which is you take the so-called facts, empirical facts, names, dates, places, times, numbers of dead, you know, leaders, this kind of thing, of battles, and then you try to somehow get a history, what we call history, or what they call history. I don't call that history. That was not the essential question of the Peloponnesian Wars, and it's precisely Lynn who has raised in the modern time that the collapse of Athenian society was based, or the result of the collapse of Athenian society led to the Peloponnesian Wars, and later the ultimate physical annihilation of Athens. The reason they would argue, as Hansen does, that there was just an interregnum is it was a way, look, they got Lynn and LaRouche on their mind because they know that Lynn and the American system, attached to Lynn's profound comprehension of this, is a strategic threat of the highest magnitude, as they learned during the Alito fight. We were recently told by a top aide to a very, very senior state, a congressman, that nothing was going on in the Alito fight until we entered, and he said it was a sea change. It was like a sea change. So therefore, they're obsessed with Lynn. Nobody talks about the Peloponnesian Wars or writes long books on them, except as a way of attempting to refute what Lynn has said.
Jerry, in a sense, you could say they're not just defending sophistry, but they're applying it to history then.
Exactly. This is exactly what they do.
So what did lead to the collapse of Athens then and the Peloponnesian War?
Well, it was very specific. What happened was that if you take it from the standpoint of Solon, which was several hundred year or a hundred or so years before the start of the Peloponnesian War, Solon had established in Athens a principle of the general welfare. He wrote a constitution in the form of a poem, and one of the critical elements of that was the poverty through the debt of the majority of the farmers and artisans was killing Athenian society. And the landowners were increasingly rapacious in collecting the debt. So Solon, who was a good Samaritan, very honest broker, and trusted by both the farmers and the artisans in the city and even the landowners, because this was leading to a massive impasse and society would have fallen apart, asked him to come up with a solution. And in that, he developed one question of a moratorium on debt, and particularly for the farmers and the artisans. Though the debt would be recognized, there would be a moratorium on it. Mm-hmm. In many cases, it was forgiven. But that they could not, they would have to do productive activity, right, in order to acquire more debt. And both the farmers and the artisans would have to do productive activity in order to acquire more debt. So the first act, but it was all in defense of the general welfare, that Solon did was create, on the one hand, an idea of the general welfare. And certainly the checks and balances that he had put in the Athenian constitution and the relationship between the debtor and the creditor and the different relationships of how much land you could have and this kind of thing, and that you'd have to work the land. You couldn't just hold it, right? All these reforms created an idea. It was created by an idea of man, which Solon had. And this was part of a general impulse tendency, which Thales, Pythagoras and others were part of this really Greek Renaissance.
And so this, in fact, is what, when historians refer to the Golden Age of Greece, this is what they should be referring to.
Exactly. The same way that in America you would refer to Lincoln, or you could even refer to Franklin Delano Roosevelt as a resurgence and in a sense a renaissance, where our country started. But really, what people call the golden generation is this crazy boomer generation, right? And the same thing is what they did with Pericles. So if you take it from the high point of Solon and what the idea of man is, Solon fought for what we call a universal physical principle, which is called the general welfare. He had others who keying off of that idea, particularly Aeschylus and later Sophocles in a different way, who were after Solon and really was part of a real Greek resurgence of both science and art and technologies that occurred in the wake of that, right? That what you had was an in-depth education of the population as to the nature of justice and the nature of man.
Mm-hmm. Now, Jerry, when you say in-depth education, if you, I know you are a great admirer of Aeschylus, Sophocles, and I believe also Euripides. Was this part of that educational system?
That was the central part. That's the way that the Greek tribes both got the most advanced education in language and history was through these tragedies. And Homer started this whole process with his Iliad and the Odyssey. So there was a literacy movement, not in terms of writing, but there was a literacy in language, a literacy in history, what had happened to Greece when they fought the crazy wars in Troy, which had destroyed Greek society and was always a touchstone for sanity, is the rejection of arbitrary war and arbitrary power, right? Now, in the wake of that, the Greeks were capable of defeating the Persian Empire, both at the Battle of Marathon on the ground and very significantly at the Battle of Salamis on the sea. And the Persians were run by the Babylonians. The elites of Persia were trained by the Babylonian priesthood, which was pure evil. Spoken about in the Bible, also the Whore of Babylon, that kind of thing, right? But the point was that the Persians were being deployed by the Babylonians to invade the Ionian areas, which were colonies of the Greeks, and then later the Peloponnesus, which was the mainland of the Greeks, and Attica, which is where Athens was, right? Now, the Athenians, because of the idea of man and the kind of society that they had, you know, the Spartans never fought at the Battle of Marathon. You know, the famous marathon run to get the Spartans to come up. The Athenians had already defeated the Persians on land at Marathon in an extraordinary battle. But they had represented a much higher idea of man and civilization and cohesion. It was not a horde. They were fighting for an idea, much as the American soldiers had fought for an idea during the fight against fascism and Hitler, right? They were fighting for an idea that Athens was an idea. It was a physical place for sure, but it was an idea developed by Solon, developed later by others, Sophocles, particularly Aeschylus, an idea of justice, an idea of all men really have and deserve and should be have justice. Now, after the defeat of the Persians, which Athens was the leading fighters, particularly at Salamis, which the Themistocles was a brilliant battle, literally had to trick the Athenians from not running away because they were so outnumbered. A very interesting story. But after the defeat of the Persians, the cult of Apollo at Delphi, right, which was run, frankly, by the Babylonians and the priests of Babylon through the Persian priests, right, and was a banking center. Increasingly, they made a counteroffensive, a cultural counteroffensive against Athens.
All right, Jerry, we'll come right back to that in a second. I just want to make sure our listeners know they're listening to the LaRouche Show. If you have questions for Jerry or for the LIM panelists who will be on shortly, you can email them to us at radio@larouchepub.com. That's radio@larouchepub, LAROUCHEPUB.com. Now, Jerry, I want to make this point also before you continue.
Sure.
Because some of our listeners sit there and say, well, this is all very interesting, but how does this enable us to fight fascism today? Now, I think at this point, we're now looking at what it was that Victor Davis Hanson and the Straussians are trying to cover up, which is, what was it that led to the destruction of classical Athens? So So proceed.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly the point. That they understood strategically that if Athens remained committed to that idea, then the strategic hold that Babylon had over Persia and the strategic games that they played through the cult of Apollo at Delphi could be defeated. The Athenians did not consult the cult of Apollo to fight the Persians, because the Persians had told everybody who consulted them, don't fight. They're too big. Make a deal. Let the satrap become a satrap or a protectorate of the Persian Empire, which was run by Babylon, right? So what happened at that point, which gets to the core of the question, is that critical intellectuals were recruited to a different idea of power, different than Solon. It's called sophistry. Literally, that's where the word sophistry comes from, which means that so-called knowledge was power, not universal physical principles like the general welfare and the development of science, but that rhetoric, the ability to confuse your enemies and defend your friends and mobilize the mob to do either, was what they call power. This is identified by the dialogue in the Republic by Thrasymachus, right? And most of the dialogues that Plato writes are attacks on sophistry. But this sophistry was originally set up by Parmenides, who was the what they call the Eleatics, right? And the Eleatics, like Zeno and Parmenides, said that there was no truth.
Now, Jerry, how do you take a society which has been through the works of Homer, the idea of Solon, that this is real to them through the tragedies which they see every year at the great festivals, how do you take a society that has a developed sense of its potential and win people over to the idea that there is no truth?
Well, what the problem in society in general has been is that only a very small number of people, and what we would call an elite, actually understand the principles upon which society is created. And it's been the subject of the great philosophers and thinkers, how do we get the general population to think for themselves, but think from the standpoint of principles, not from the standpoint of power. Right? I mean, from the standpoint of power, not from the standpoint of influence, right? In other words, the question for society is how do we increase the relative potential population density of society, or as called in the Constitution, the general welfare. Unfortunately, too few people, because of the educational system, and this is where the LaRouche Youth Movement becomes so unique, force people to go through the rigor of discovering for themselves questions of universal principle. And therefore, they have to take on the basis of opinion, what's called authoritative opinion, what is true and what is not true. And then you're stuck arguing authorities, right? When you start from the standpoint of Solon, when you start from the standpoint of the Founding Fathers, when you start from the standpoint of Lyndon LaRouche, the question for society is the increase in the relative potential population density per square kilometer of society. In other words, if you have a good society, the result of that society will be the increase in density of population, and therefore, and also the increase in the living standards of that population while you're increasing the density of that population.
Well, and then that brings you right back to the question of your concept of the nature of man, because if you believe that man is capable of mastering the discovery of universal physical principles, then you organize a society around that.
That's exactly it. And you see the difference, because you saw at the so-called height, the so-called Pericles, the age of Pericles, because Pericles was the one who organized the Peloponnesian Wars, right? And he was trained by the sophists of his time. And Pericles argues in a very famous dialogue in his funeral oration after the first year of the Peloponnesian Wars, and then later what had happened to Athens in the Melian dialogue, right, which is all in Thucydides, who was there at the time, points out that rhetoric, pleasing rhetoric, to sway opinion, was the basis upon which they fought the Peloponnesian Wars. There was no basis for the war in Sparta. They started the war. The way they started the war is because Athens was at the height of its power, because after the defeat of Persia, Athens, through the sophists and through the cult of Apollo at Delphi, were looting all the what was called the Delian League, where all the different city-states of Greece were paying tribute to maintain the fleet of Athens. And they started using the money not for the fleet, but all sorts of other things. And certain key people in Athens decided that they were going to become an empire. But you see, the question of an empire, and I'm not going to read it because we don't have time, but if you look at Thucydides, the question of the Melian dialogue, in which they were going to invade this island of Melos, right, during the Peloponnesian Wars. And they said, well, we've been neutral. Why don't you give us justice? So the argument explicitly is justice is the power of the stronger over the weaker. And that is the argument of Thrasymachus in the Republic. And that was Leo Strauss's argument. And that is the argument of the fascists, right?
That's the argument today of Addington, of John Yoo, and the theorists like Alito behind the President Bush administration.
Exactly.
Administration.
Exactly. And the problem is that, and this is why they had to take on Lynn on this question, is that the Peloponnesian Wars ended in the destruction of Athens. In other words, it's not that they won the war. They destroy over a 30-year period through several perturbations, backs and forth. Pericles dies very early in the war. Then a certain so-called democracy takes over, and then the Sparta finally wins and imposes tyrants, but then they get overthrown. And finally, at the end of the Peloponnesian Wars, with the total destruction of Athens in terms of an idea of Athens for the general welfare, they kill Socrates in 399 after the destruction of Athens. So that in fact, they have to argue that Athens wasn't destroyed by the Peloponnesian Wars, because in fact it was, because these ideas are not coherent with the laws of the universe. And therefore, if you hold to these ideas, Persia, you don't hear about the great Babylonian Empire or the great Persian Empire, except in the fantasies of some people. You don't hear anything about the great empires of the past, because empires are based upon a rejection of a fundamental universal physical principles. And therefore, the universe itself, because they cannot sustain the populations by looting them. You can't sustain population by perpetual war. You don't hear about the Roman Empire anymore. This looted all of Europe to maintain a certain oligarchical elite. All of Asia, they attempted to loot everything in sight, and ultimately they collapsed. They physically collapsed.
Well, Jerry, I think this is exactly the point why we're looking at someone like Victor Davis Hanson and the Straussians and the neocons, because they're trying to make an argument that empire, in fact, is the only appropriate form for government today. And what Lyndon LaRouche said yesterday is that what the new defense policy of Rumsfeld, what Cheney's trying to do with the war against Iran, is in fact to revive the imperial doctrine in the same way that it was revived under Hitler and the Nazis under the same synarchist banking elite in the 30s.
Absolutely. And it's very dramatic. You really only have two ideas of man. There are perturbations of it. there are certain arguments that are more advanced and less advanced. But it's this fundamental question that Lynn always comes back to. Is man an animal, or does man have a soul? And on the basis of that soul, can discover universal physical principles and apply them, right, to the well-being of mankind. And what happens under these kinds of sophists, right, this idea that there's no universal principle, it's whatever you can convince. Look at the problem on the Alito case, right? One of the problems of the boomer generation is that the idea of telling the truth is out of vogue. Even if it gets you in trouble, right? You have to tell the truth, because the truth was not told about Alito, even though people had some good impulses on this. The result was that Cheney, Addington, Yo, this whole crowd got Alito in, and they are now on an offensive to start a war with Iran. But had anyone stood up and said simply, Alito reminds me of the arguments of Carl Schmitt, who was the Nazi justice minister. Had any senator stood up and said what was clearly true, it wouldn't even matter whether we won the vote, because that would be a declaration of war, as was World War II, when we entered the war against fascism. And the population of this country have had it with the sophistry on both sides of the aisle, both Republicans and Democrats. Yes, there are Nazis. A lot of sophists are not Nazis, right? But the only way you can defeat this is not by playing within the rules of the game. As long as you play within the rules of the game and play the sophist game of influencing opinion, authoritative opinion, look, you're up against the synarchists. They have trillions of dollars. You cannot fight them on their own grounds. You've got to go to the people of this country. You've got to speak the truth. Because 90% of the population, it used to be 80, now it's 90% of the population, have lost almost everything. They are deeply in debt. Many of them are losing their jobs. Most of them have lost their pension fund. Most of them have lost their health care. Most of them are facing ruin from their children, from the kind of nonsense which is taught at universities. And therefore, you cannot play by the rules of the game. And that's what sophists do. They try to influence people within the rules of the game by starting with the same assumptions that there is no truth, there is only authoritative opinion.
All right, Jerry, we're going to have to take a short break in just a moment, but I think you put the case on the table. And we'll be coming back after this break with our two panelists from the LaRouche Youth Movement, both of whom have been studying Plato and should be quite up on this question. So you're listening to The LaRouche Show. The LaRouche Show is live on the web every Saturday from 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time. It is also available on archives. You can go on to the LaRouchePub.com site and scroll over to the left-hand side of the page where it says The LaRouche Show, and we have the last 2 or 3 or maybe even 4 years of broadcasts, including some with Lyndon LaRouche, including recent shows on the Children of Satan 4, one that was specifically on the doctrine of Carl Schmitt. And this is available for anyone listening to the show and has access to the Internet. You can get on it and listen to it. Now, we have produced the Children of Satan 4 pamphlet plus the webcast pamphlet from January 11th. Those are available to our listeners if you call our toll-free number, which is 888-347-3258. And that's available. Just call at any time and tell them you want to organize. You want to go out and defeat the sophists. There will also be a webcast coming up, and I'll mention this again later on, February 23rd. I presume it will be 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Another webcast from Lyndon LaRouche, where he'll be addressing the fight to stop the new fascist war that Cheney and the neocons are preparing. So for organizing with us, getting out literature, anything of that sort, call us at 888-347-3258. We're back now with Jerry Rose. We've just been discussing this whole question of the importance of understanding history, living in history. And we have two representatives from the LaRouche Youth Movement who are part of a small group of the young generation who actually are finding out what it means to live in history, to act on the stage of history, and not merely be influenced by the sophistry of society to go along, to get along. So let me first bring on from Los Angeles, Quincy O'Neill. Quincy, do you have some comments or questions for Jerry? Quincy, you there? Do you have the mute on, Quincy?
Stand by.
Okay. Jerry, we seem to have a slight technical problem here.
Okay, no problem.
Well, while we're waiting, Jerry, when you see this problem of sophistry in the Congress, how do you get this across to people? I mean, you say that people are angry. I guess the real question is they've got to see some leadership.
That's it. I mean, in other words, unfortunately, as you asked before, how could such a society that had reached such a high standard have fallen so low? And this is the problem of all societies. And this is why I am so enthusiastic about the kind of program that Lynn and you and Phil and others are running with the LaRouche Youth Movement. Because it's a mass-based, what you call mange brigades, in which the emphasis is on the discovery of principle, universal physical principle, and applying that to different geometric discoveries and then certainly artistic discoveries.
Jerry, I think we've made connection with Quincy. You there?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead, Quincy. Sorry about that.
We kind of got cut off. What were you?
Well, what we were just talking about is Jerry was just discussing his enthusiasm for the way the LaRouche Youth Movement has been created as a kind of powerful anti-sophist device in the population. So I was just wondering if you had some thoughts on that and what you've heard previously on this question of the nature of the battle.
No, it's the question. It's central. Whether we're at a campus or making some political intervention, this is what comes up. We are presenting an idea to them, and they don't have a format, a method to understand what we're saying, and it ultimately shuts down some of the conversations that we'd want to have with the people who are honest. But it will quickly and can quickly turn into what Jerry was referencing, this questioning of authorities. And that becomes, you know, your discussion if you're not careful. Just the other day it happened. And what happens is that the person has to then either decide to further investigate and figure out what we're saying about the American system or about some scientific concept, and then us have another conversation. But particularly in the recent development, the Alito fight, the process of us getting this resolution passed against the Alito nomination, having that be the official stance of the California Democratic Party, at the resolutions committee, this question came up. Us identifying Alito as a follower of Schmitt's doctrine and calling them Nazis, and the people there as part of the committee not saying that it wasn't true, but saying that we couldn't say that.
Now, Quincy, that was in the resolution, right, that there was a whereas clause identifying Alito as a follower of Schmitt, the jurist for Hitler.
Right, and the discussion was whether to strike that clause so that the first two clauses identifying the unitary executive theory and the signing statement would remain, but the third clause we'd have to strike. And when the question of truth was brought up, the chair of the committee, who's head of the Teachers Federation and has been on the committee for 35 years, said, well, you know, we should discuss, you know, what truth is, because truth, you know, isn't the same to everybody. And it was very much, it was striking for us, the LaRouche Youth Movement members present, because it was in a minor way a reenactment of a Plato dialogue. We're like, oh, there it is. It's just right there, that question. And in preparations for the convention, we've turned our focus back on some of the dialogues because that's, you know, that's where we have to start. Here we go again. We have to find a way to get at the American system, but first be able to address this question of sophistry and how the party won't be able to function if it continues with it. But then there's also in the people coming up to us after the passing of the revolution saying, well, you know, you were right. And, you know, we couldn't get it passed because there's a late resolution and there are rules to it, but what you were saying was right. So there is motion where there's a fight that, you know, we've started and people are recognizing that we cannot continue.
Because so the resolution that you introduced as a member of the LaRouche Youth Movement and also an alternate County Democratic Central Committee member, the resolution passed, but they did strike out the clause that identified Alito as a follower of Nazi doctrine.
They did.
Yes.
They did.
Okay.
And, yeah.
Well, I think, so that, Jerry, that gets right at what we're talking
doesn't
about,
it?
Doesn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah, and that is the weakness of the Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. And that's why we have to lead the Democratic Party.
You well, know, one of the people who's been involved in the fight in D.C. is our other LIM panelist today, Randy Kim. And, Randy, what's your sense of the state of sophistry in Washington?
Well, that's that's definitely an interesting question to ask here. It's a very, very funny town, as I think John McCain once said in one of these situations. I think it's a good example to look at because certainly you have institutional schools here like Georgetown and George Washington University who pump out young people who then become interns and then later on move on to positions of power in the Justice Department and the Department of Defense and certainly the Congress and the Senate. A lot of the younger people you find here come from these schools from all around the country. And the comment that Jerry was making about the Mons Brigade process and the LaRouche Youth Movement is really, really is essential because our generation is really in a unique position, especially in the city of D.C., to illustrate the shortcomings, the sophistic tendencies of, number one, the baby boomer generation, yet at the same time take those of our generation who are being groomed right now for positions within the government and attack them from the standpoint of us being members of that generation, showing them, okay, these are the results, the consequences of 30 years of our parents' sophistic decision-making in policy in the government in Washington, D.C. And, it's an interesting fight. You had at George Washington University this past week, a number of us went onto the campus, identified law professors who are members of the Federalist Society, the same society that Justice Alito is now is a part of, and we called them out openly in class, broke the ice of this professional academic world and said, hey, look, you guys are members of the Federalist Society. You know, this is what these guys believe in. Do you support this, or are you going to rip up your membership card and show your students that you're actually a person of principle? And a number of these people really flipped out to such a degree that there was somewhat of a slander run in the student newspaper. And then afterward, a few days after that, a student radio station by the name The Voices of Reason invites two of our members on and really has a frank discussion with them about our methods and about why it's important and why we can say that Alito is a student of Nazi legal theory. So it's a very interesting situation here in D.C.
Just out of curiosity, did any of the professors rip up their membership cards?
No, I don't believe so. They hid behind the idea that it's just a nice group that talks about ideas. And ironically enough, one of the professors then proceeded to give a class in this intervention of multiple instances where the United States has unilaterally violated international law and how this can happen over and over again, and that's no problem.
Well, one of the most sophistic aspects of the so-called Federalist Society is they try to say start with Alexander Hamilton.
Right.
Now, in Federalist Paper number 69, Hamilton argues violently and very forcefully that the president is not a king, because they had to, in the Federalist Papers, convince the state of New York to adopt the Constitution in order to get it through, because there had to be unanimous adoption of the Constitution. And in Federalist Paper number 69, he argues absolutely clearly and decisively upon the checks and balances on the President of the United States. The President of the United States cannot declare war, as kings of old did. The President of the United States cannot levy troops, as kings of old did. The President of the United States cannot levy money for those troops, as kings of old did. And therefore, to say that they're quoting Hamilton, they are quoting Carl Schmitt. They're not quoting Hamilton. That's sophistry.
Right.
In other words, the essence of sophistry is to take a word like federalism, right, which was a perfectly good word, and it comes from this idea of e pluribus unum, out of many one, right, and a federal idea of the Constitution with checks and balances. That's the idea of federalism, the actual idea of federalism. They're not talking about federalism. When they talk about the unitary executive, it is absolutely argued vociferously by Hamilton himself that this is absolutely illegal, unconstitutional, and everything we had founded this nation not to be. That's a real sophistry.
And Lyndon LaRouche brought up another example of this at the Cadre School address to California last week, where he said, so these guys want to be followers of Hamilton? How about supporting the National Bank? How about supporting regulation of commerce? And, of course, we've seen this on campuses across the country, as Randy was saying. Quincy, I assume we've run into precisely the same thing on the campuses on the West Coast.
Yeah, very much so. It's not much different at all. The same at UCLA or the Claremont Colleges. It's the same. But In the interventions with the professors, it might take this form with some of the people, but with the students, they're not even in the ball game. They're not aware that there's a conflict. But what's in our favor is, and this has to be underlined, both in our work on the campuses and in discussing with younger members of the party structure, that as Athens did fall because they did execute Socrates, the reality is that things are falling apart. And when we counterpose what they've been taught, their ideas, versus the reality, reality is beginning to win a lot of them over to at least go investigate. And so we find ourselves in a very fortunate position, because we do have the truth. We do have a program that's proven that is the American system. And that that is spurring all kinds of meetings, places like UC Santa Barbara and UC San Diego, where we're finding that there is interest in a plan. And they're recognizing that there isn't a plan and are willing to talk.
Jerry, you've been watching the and involved in the organizing for well over 30 years. I think you're probably like me, that you thought years ago that all we had to do is tell the truth and people would end up flocking to us.
Yes.
So I guess this question of sophistry really is much more profound than most people think.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, because most people, even people who are well-meaning, have to begin to consider what is going to happen to their nation if they continue to go along to get along.
Mm-hmm.
They have to consider this. The handwriting's on the wall.
Mm-hmm.
You have, in the nature of Alito, in the nature of Cheney, in the nature of their commitments, what they did in the wake of Katrina, what they're about to do to Iran, what they're about to do to our own military, the torture, the handwriting's on the wall. And it's for the people who we're talking to. They can no longer go along to get along. They cannot do that. What will happen is what happened to Athens, what happened to Rome, what happened to Sparta, what happened to Persia, what happened to Babylon, what happened to every empire in history. It if you violate for too long the laws of the universe, then you will destroy the physical capability of your own population to survive. And we are at that decision-making point. If Cheney and the synarchists who put in Hitler are not stopped, which they're the people who put in Cheney and Bush, right, then we are facing a dark age. Not like our enemies, because, again, you don't really read about the Babylonian Empire, do you, right now? It's not exactly a current question, right? You don't read about the Roman Empire right now, although it morphed a couple of times. There's an argument about that, but I'm not going to make it at this point. You don't read about that because they destroyed themselves. If America goes the way of an empire, if people think they're going to be anything but slaves to a few oligarchs, and they think they're going to be lackeys and suck up, there ain't going to be a whole lot of those people who can suck up. Hmm? The 80 to 90% of this country are going to be ground to nothing. And therefore, they have to face this idea of getting along, going along to get along.
Well, let me ask Randy, who has been spending some time pounding the pavement in Washington and going into the Senate and House offices. Are we getting that point through? Are they beginning to get a sense that the population is not happy with the way they're handling things?
I think you could say it's a sense. I wouldn't say it's complete by any means. You see that there was a Democratic Party reaction to Bush's state of his mental health address, or however people want to refer to it, over the health care issue. And you do have... You do have people who work in these institutions, in the Senate, in the House, who work for the congressman, the congresswoman, the senator, the representatives, and they're very important. In fact, in the Alito fight, you had a number of them, some offices that have been somewhat hostile to our organization, opening up and having meetings with us for the first time. You had, I believe, the chief counsels for some very important offices threatening to resign based on the way people were voting on this Alito confirmation. Then, at the same time, you have like secretaries who are just wet behind the ears, and they haven't lived in Capitol Hill for a very long time, who think they know what's going on. Who, when we try to get an ad hoc appointment or something like that, an off-the-cuff meeting, they try to throw away our literature or something like that. And you really get to get under their skins being part of this organization by calling them on this culture, this kind of culture of corruption. The Democrats have labeled the Republican apparatus around Abramoff and these guys and what Bush and Cheney are doing. There's a bit of a culture of corruption within some of the young... young liberal volunteers and aides and staffers in some of the offices. But look, a lot of important people realize that the population of the United States wants them to stand on a certain principle, and this is why you're seeing such open reaction to us, bringing us into a process when before saying the types of things we've been saying has really turned them off. we continue to name our pamphlets the Children of Satan and things like this, and the reception gets better and better because they realize that we're the ones who tell the truth and we're the ones who can really mobilize and rally the people behind them.
Mm-hmm. Let me just comment on this because one of the aspects of the mobilization against Alito was very much focused on the county chairman of the Democratic Party. And we did this much of this work out of the National Center. And when the dust settled, we had gotten 530 county chairmen to deploy 54,000 pamphlets, 3.2 tons of literature, in the course of a two-week period. Most significantly, had we called them with anything less than the truth, that Alito and the people behind him are Nazis, and they're pushing a Nazi theory of law about the unitary executive, had we said anything less than that, they would not have mobilized. But when we said the truth, because they had the smell of this thing, and nothing but that kind of clarity and honesty, would they have mobilized? If Howard Dean had called them and said, these guys are racist and sexist, forget it. They are. There's no question about that. But that's their better qualities. You know, that's the stuff that they, you know, seem...
The least offensive qualities.
Least offensive qualities, right? That's not the issue. The issue is they're trying to destroy our government and the commitment to the general welfare by imposing a dictatorship on this country.
I think you can make the argument, Jerry, that Hitler was also a sexist.
Certainly.
You're listening to The LaRouche Show. We have a little bit more than 8 minutes to go. I want to remind people again that on February 23rd, we will have another one in the string of international webcasts given by Lyndon LaRouche. This will be February 23rd, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. And these webcasts have been sort of the rallying point around which the Democratic Party was picked off its back, after the November 2004 election and put into a fighting mode. Now, I want to just, Quincy, I'd like you to just talk for a minute about the kind of work that the LaRouche Youth Movement has done to get at this question of sophistry. You've done a lot of Plato readings in the Monge Brigades. How does that work?
Well, we've done... several Plato readings. We'll focus for weeks at a time on a dialogue, and we found that we had to slow down first and go almost dialogue for dialogue, within the dialogue to really figure out what was happening, but also a process of getting every member of the group to verbalize what they thought was going on, and even as an assignment, provide an example somewhere in the economic policy or somewhere in a scientific question that made the same point as a dialogue. For instance, in T.M. Theotetus' dialogue, this is one of the ones our brigade worked on. But it's also the more general dialogue with some of the other great minds in that lineage, Leibniz especially, in his confrontations with Locke in the new essays. Kuza, we've been trying to broaden the dialogue and see how the different figures in specific instances were making the same point. And that has largely been the process. And it's been successful because sometimes, because we haven't done as much of the historical work that, say, someone like Jerry has done, it doesn't... we have trouble bridging the gap between what we're discussing, say what Lynn would discuss in a paper like Visualizing the Complex Domain, or even recently the Riemann and Kant paper on the shape of space. And so we're definitely in bringing in the context into the process, having them read the Plato dialogue, and then taking them to the scientific fight and showing the parallel. And showing them that it's the exact same fight, the exact same discussion.
I think the issue here is that when Lynn says that he's 2,000 to 3,000 years old, he means it. That he actually has a sense of living in that. And Jerry, I think you're getting older, aren't you?
Yeah, well, let me just read you something which I brought to the studio here, in a sense, almost to wrap it up. because this is Federalist Paper number 6, written by Alexander Hamilton. And I want you to know the actual view that the Founding Fathers had of Pericles. So let me read this to you. The celebrated Pericles, in compliance with the resentment of a prostitute, at the expense of much of the blood and treasure of his countrymen, attacked, vanquished, and destroyed the city of the Samnians. The same man, Pericles, stimulated by private pique against the Megarensians, another nation of Greece, or to avoid a prosecution which he was threatened as an accomplice in a supposed theft of the statuary of Phidias, or to get rid of the accusations prepared to be brought against him for dissipating the funds of the state in the purchase of popularity, or from a combination of all these causes, was the primitive author of that famous and fatal war, distinguished in the Grecian annals by the name of the Peloponnesian War, which, after various vicissitudes, intermissions, and renewals, terminated in the ruin of the Athenian Commonwealth. That's a quote from Alexander Hamilton on Federalist Paper number 6.
I guess Victor Davis Hanson must have missed that one.
He missed it, yes.
Along with all of the so-called Federalists.
And all the Federalist Society guys who quote Hamilton. And that is the essence of sophistry. You take the content out. And you, by having the power to write books and have them published and getting the press to make authoritative commentary, you actually say the exact opposite of what was known by the Founding Fathers. To quote that the Federalist Society had come from Alexander Hamilton when he understood both the Peloponnesian Wars and the idea and attacked them violently.
So this question of getting a truth really is a life and death situation for civilization.
As Hamilton understood.
Yeah.
And as Lynn has understood from the beginning.
And I think increasingly as the LaRouche Youth Movement is understanding. Randy, do you have any, we have a little more than 2.5 minutes. Do you have any final thoughts?
I think the Democratic Party is finally getting over the holiday eggnog, and population seems to be more than willing to say to the Democrats, hey, look, we've kicked Bush's butt all year long. One battle loss doesn't mean the war has to be forfeited.
Absolutely.
Jerry, you have any final thoughts?
Well, I think this has been an excellent dialogue because I hope that the audience has a sense of this is not some esoteric question. The question of truth. And the speaking of truth, you know, it was, I forget who said this, Harley, you may remember. The an honest man is one who speaks truth to power. Do you know who said, I can't remember who said that, but I always think that's a good way to think.
Well, I'll take credit for it.
Okay. Harley, okay, I'll quote you next time. As Harley recently told me, no, speak truth to power. As long as we...
Isn't there a tradition called the Parhesiastes of, you know, around that period in Greek history? And I guess Parhesiastes, or the translation, meant speaking truth to power?
Yes, I think you're right. I think that's what that's what I'm referring to. Absolutely.
Okay.
And that is what we must do. If we do that, truth is on our side. And that's the only way that we can get out of the trouble we're in. And people want leadership. So those of you who are out there, speak truth to power. We can take them. We're the majority.
And as Lyndon LaRouche has always said, there's nothing to fear. You are going to die anyway, sooner or later. The question is whether you have the courage to live for something. And I think this is why Lynn has been an inspiration to so many people in so many nations. Because as he also said, and this time I know I'm quoting him accurately, he said, I'll never lose because I will never give up.
That's for sure.
And he says he cannot be beaten because he'll never quit. And I think that's the exclamation point. But I do appreciate, Jerry, you joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure.
Randy from Washington, D.C., and Quincy from Los Angeles, keep up the good work. You've been listening to The LaRouche Show. We're live every Saturday at 3 p.m. Eastern, and if you're not listening next week, you're going to miss something important for your life because you only have one life, and you might as well live it in history. So for The LaRouche Show, this is Harley Schlanger. Goodbye until next week.
Okay. Bye-bye.